Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have another founder, you know, another repeated founder. He's done it a couple of times and right now he's riding a rocket ship, man. But we're going to be talking about all types of good stuff. We're going to be talking about pivoting. We're going to be talking about getting large accounts from large customers. We're going to be talking about figuring out scale. But again, the whole thing that we like to hear, building, scaling, financing, and beyond. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Jason Wyatt. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me and really appreciate you letting me speak to your community.
So originally born and raised in Melbourne. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you, Jason?
As Australians, we're pretty fortunate. You know, Australia's such a beautiful country. It's got a very safe and stable government. But, you know, we had an amazing upbringing with an amazing family. Yeah, and, you know, my father was ultimately a business person. So he sort of drilled it into us from day one, you know, the love and passion for business and helping people with their problems they need to be solved.
So you also went to university there. You know, and basically you did the whole thing in accounting. You know, why accounting out of all things?
You know, it's really interesting, like, because when people meet me, I'm obviously not a born accountant. Let's say I'm a born salesperson, if anything. But, you know, Dad growing up, he was actually an accountant and started accounting practice. So no different to most kids, you know, if the apple doesn't necessarily fall that far from the tree and followed in his footsteps. But, you know, from about the age of 11, you know, he never forced me, but he encouraged me to, you know, pick up the financial paper and read 5 pages every single day, you know, just so I could start to learn about business, learn about those concepts. And then, you know, I got good marks at school and I didn't really know what to do. So rather than picking something generalist, I picked a commerce degree where it could be quite open and keep my choices open as a, you know, 18-year-old boy who was sort of discovering the world. And you know, eventually I got pretty good marks and then, you know, went to one of those career days that you have at a college or a university, and, you know, KPMG and all the big accounting firms were there and they sort of scouted you and recruited you and lured you in with a big hook to say how great they are and sort of, you know, what that career progression would take. So, you know, I just took the opportunity and I look back on it now with reflection and, you know, ultimately, you know, was I ever going to be an accountant? Zero chance. But what it gave me was an amazing background. You know, no one can fool you now. You've got that little weapon in your pocket around understanding P&L and cash flow and all those things, a good basis behind it.
Now, for you, you ended up going to London. You know, you left Melbourne, you go to London. I guess what kind of worldview or change in perspective did it give you to see what was outside of Melbourne?
It just completely opens your mind, doesn't it? You go to a great big city like London and, you know, I was a massive surfer growing up. I remember actually catching a tube from Heathrow London Tube and, you know, I had a bag on one shoulder and I had my surfboard. I had 4 surfboards on the other shoulder thinking that all I was going to do is go over there and party and surf the coast of France amongst it. But you get off this tube and you look up at the city and you've got nowhere to live. You've got no job, you've got no money. So very quickly, you're a little kid in a big city and you've got to learn survival, right, which is one of the primary functions of life within it. But, you know, a city like London's just sensational. It's got so much diversity. So it's so cosmopolitan. It's so much fun. But it can teach you so much, but it can also spit you out if you don't change and adapt and put yourself in the environments where you can be successful.
And you also went through different companies, as you were saying. I mean, you did Morgan Stanley, you did Reuters, a little bit of everything. You know, I guess, say, what do you think was the pivotal moment for you that really got you to be like, okay, now it's my time now to take over my own destiny and create my own future?
I was sitting there working in London and, you know, you're working banking or you're working finance. And you're working in decimal points or basis points, and there's no innovation really in the product. You know, you talk about spreads and whether I can make a 0.001 of a more margin today, or you're working in accounting and you're working in the past. So the whole time you're focused on doing financial reports or telling people what's happened, and you're not really focused on telling people what's going to happen or shaping what's going to happen. So the pivotal thing for me is that I think I was just ultimately completely bored. There was just like the places, the cultures were great fun. The companies were good companies. They were just boring in what they did, if that makes sense.
So then how did the whole idea of Bike Exchange come together?
My best friend and I, Sam Salter, he was living in Melbourne at the time. His family was from a cycling industry and he had a classified background. So before marketplaces, there was classifieds, things of cars.com and those types of businesses where you couldn't actually. And then I fundamentally at the same time wanted to get out of just working for a company and putting some of that knowledge together. So we kind of teamed up. We looked at the market at the time and we said, you know what, there's more bikes sold than cars. These bikes are often $10,000 to $20,000. We looked at the industry and said, the bike shops are never going to be able to figure out back in 2007, never going to figure out SEO and SEM and online marketing. And the consumer was demanding, you know, a single destination where we could provide ease, convenience, and choice for their consumer journey and just make it easier for them to buy. So when we look at those forces together, you know, like it's a great industry with a big TAM. The industry is ripe for disruption. And we knew a model that was going to work within it that we could scale quite quickly. And from day one, Bike Exchange worked, which is fascinating, right? Because, and you know, I remember the first single day we put the website up. Within an hour, there were people talking and communicating through it. And within a week, there were 500. And then within a month, there were thousands. So quite often, the market speaks whether it's a good idea or not. And in this case, the market spoke quite quickly.
And you were there for about 7 years. I mean, how was that journey? I mean, 7 years in a startup is like a lifetime.
It is like a lifetime in there. But again, when we think of it back then, the access to good technologists and the access, you know, it's not like living in Melbourne. We were living in the Bay in San Francisco, right? Like, so it's a different sort of acceleration path. So you had to graft it out a little bit more. You had to, you know, we had to take our time. It wasn't as easy to raise money in this market back then as it is now. But what we quickly realized is, you know, the bike business was really good. And then in 2012, we won Telstra, like an Australian business, small business of the year, right? Like, so we just spun it up and it was humming along. And on the back of that, actually many people approached us and said, can we use your platform to do, you know, we don't want to do a bike marketplace, but we want to do a babies and kids marketplace, or we want to do a furniture marketplace. And then we just constantly got these inbound calls and emails from people saying, hey, I want to do that same model, but in a different industry. And that's really sort of when Marketplacer was born. You know, we had a very different model back then. You know, we took an equity stake in their business. We took a license fee behind their business. Platform wasn't built for any product at that time. But what it did, it taught us that maybe our biggest asset wasn't actually the bike business, but probably the technology business that the bike business was built on.
So then at what point do you decide this time to walk away? Because, I mean, this is also your first company, your first baby. You know, I think that eventually when it's your first company, you know, it happens many times for entrepreneurs that you think you are the company. You become attached to it in every shape and form, especially after 7 years. What happened there for you to decide it was time to turn page?
Well, when you're working 18 hours a day, you're involved in 9 businesses. All of them are going okay, but ultimately, it's very difficult to run that many spreads of businesses, and then you have to pick one. So I ultimately come to the decision, if we're going to be successful in Marketplace, it needs 100% of my time, 100% of my focus. And it was probably one of the biggest lessons that I learned was, you know, these things are hard. If you want them to go fast, it's 100% dedication into them. It's 100% passion into it. So, and that's exactly what I did. So I stepped off every other single board. and marketplace have got 100% of my focus with zero distraction.
So, because I know that Two Bike Exchange was listed, so what was the valuation at its peak?
It listed at its peak for about $80 million. So I walked away, I walked away before listing, but you know, had a great result out of that, and you know, it was a really great journey and a really great story. But it taught me so much around creating a marketplace, leading a team, building a technology team, and all of those things. So, you know, it was an incredible journey and an incredible result.
So then for you, eventually, you get going with Marketplacer. So obviously, you know, like after the experience with Bike Exchange, you know, doing it for 7 years, you know, you had a very good understanding on how to think about building and scaling, and also how to think about building something in a really good market. So how do you start to think about Marketplacer becoming that next, you know, part of the chapter in your journey as a founder, and why did you think it was meaningful enough for you to take action on it?
Well, when you think about the opportunity behind Marketplacer, is one thing I've always looked at is what if you're going to sell a technology product to a customer, ultimately what problem are you trying to solve? And the problem we were trying to solve was, how do we make it easier for people to sell things that they don't own? How can we make it, whether you've got a big audience, whether you've got an existing customer base, how do we make it just so seamless that you can grow without the need of opening new warehouses, to grow without the need of owning inventory, and ultimately leverage your unfair advantage, which always comes back down to your position in the market with an incredible customer base and or deep relationship with suppliers, and accelerate that at a, you know, with basically like an autopilot mentality at a speed that you would never be able to do if you were buying, owning, shipping, and sending inventory in its own right. And that's ultimately what the problem Marketplacer solves, is if you're a large retailer or a medium retailer, or you've got a big audience, how do we plug our technology, our supply base in, and ultimately put you on autopilot to scale, you know, without the need of a huge capital base behind you? And that's what we sort of went out and did, and you know, we've been fortunate enough to secure some of the best and leading contracts in the world.
So for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Marketplacer? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so we work with some of the biggest retailers like Albertsons and Tesco and retailers all over the planet. And we connect our platform into their e-commerce engine and just significantly increase their supply base. So, you know, a good example is the Gap in the United States. When you shop on the Gap, you'll see they've got the traditional Gap clothing, they've got the traditional products. But you'll also see now they've got, you know, cots and prams and all of these new categories that they've never traditionally been selling before. So all of those new categories are actually powered through the Marketplace platform. So when somebody buys something on the Gap, pushes the order back through the Marketplace platform, through the supplier. So we're effectively, the Gap wouldn't say they're waking up and creating a marketplace, but we're enabling the effectively drop ship or send third-party products and open up all of those new categories behind it. So the way we make money is we charge a monthly SaaS fee, and then we take a percentage of that of that turnover. So when we work with businesses like Tesco or Albertsons or the Gap or Woolworths in this region, which is some of the largest retailers, is not only, you know, we get the SaaS fee, but we truly see ourselves as a partner in that business, and we get a percentage of the turnover forever.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
It was quite, you know, the interesting hit on product market fit, because right away you guys, you know, started to receive a phone calls, you know, from potential customers. So how was that like? You know, it sounds like it was a really good start.
It was amazing, but it was frightening because these phone calls weren't from small little startups. They were from some of the largest retailers in the world, right? Like, so our product started effectively at enterprise, which most tech companies take 20 years to get into enterprise. So it was a really interesting, journey behind that. You know, never forget, in the same month, we had Tesco, we had Qantas, which is for the airline, and we had the Gap email us and said, hey, I want to create a marketplace. Like, it's very rare you get that in life when you can get such amazing customers contacting you. So, but, you know, it's their moats now for our business. When we think of the, you know, our customers, ultimately they're our moat in there. We've got unbelievably deep relationships, and, you know, we power a huge supply base, you know, that transforms them. You know, a good way to think about it is if you see the evolution of what Walmart's been able to do with their marketplace, even against Amazon, and it's really started to ship third-party product. You know, Walmart really started that journey before we were live, and they bought Jet.com. But what we've been able to do is enable these other incredible retailers using that platform to implement a very, very similar strategy on a global basis.
So for you guys, there was also a very important moment in time where you decided to turn off half of the product. I mean, that sounds quite scary.
It's very scary when you've got investors and you've got, you know, 40% of your revenue rolling through that segment of your business. But what we realized is, so for listeners out there, we had a full stack. So you could create a marketplace using Marketplace from scratch. So we had a marketplace commerce engine, we had the search engine, we had the shopping cart. But ultimately, really, if we were ever going to scale, it wasn't going to be through those small startups or those sort of mid-market concepts where, hey, I want to create a marketplace for a surfboard marketplace in the surfboard industry. If we were truly going to scale, we had to think of where are all the customers and how do we get into that customer base on an easier and faster basis. So then Tesco is never going to replatform their commerce engine. Albertsons are never going to replatform their commerce engine. So, you know, we had to go headless. The whole world was going to a microservice architecture and we had to go headless at speed. But in order to do that in the most modern, in the cleverest way, we had to turn off probably half of our product base. And, you know, we were never going to compete with Shopify. We were never going to compete with the likes of Salesforce Commerce Cloud. So we made the really brave decision to ultimately switch off half of the product, switch off a huge portion of our revenue. But the way I look at that is, it's like this, you know, it's like in business, you look at scaffolding, you know, you're building a building, right? The first thing sometimes, you know, you build is the scaffolding on the outside, don't you? Like, and then ultimately what comes straight through the center is the big building, which is the greatest asset of all. So when I think of Bike Exchange, when I think of the full stack offering, and they weren't necessarily mistakes because we couldn't have got here without all of that learning, but, you know, the building through the center is clearly the deep problem that we solve with Marketplace. And now, you know, we just see the TAM and the opportunity have been so big that, yeah, we're so focused on that one thing.
Now, for you guys, you were talking about investors earlier. How much capital have you guys raised to date and how has it been the journey of raising money?
We've raised about $120 million. And to be honest, the process of raising capital sucks. If anyone who tells you they like it, I think has a different mindset. You know, so you've got to go out there, you've got to really nail your story. Like, so what problem do you solve? How do you solve it? And why are people going to back you? Yeah, over the other 150 investments they're currently looking at, you know, ultimately within it. So then it's like, you know, you've got to go to multiple firms. You've got to put your heart on your sleeve the whole way through. And, you know, it's fundamentally a numbers game, because you're going to talk to many, many funds. And it's not that you don't have a good idea, or you don't have a good business, or they don't believe in you. You're just not the right fit for them. You just don't meet their metrics. You don't meet their industry. You don't meet necessarily their sort of mandates behind their funds, or it's the wrong timing. So you've got to start with a big net. You've got to get good advisors to help you on the way through. You've got to nail your story behind it. And then you've got to really, really deeply understand your metrics. You know, you've got to, as the market has become more sophisticated, you know, the metrics absolutely matter. In this market in particular, it's become probably one of the most difficult capital markets, you know, with the level of interest rate in the world. So, or in the time that I've been in business. So you've really got to understand those metrics and make sure that they believe in what you're doing, and they're going to get a great return ultimately.
So then obviously, you know, when investors make a bet, you know, and I think that it's not just investors. I mean, I think that it's also customers or employees. I think that vision is a really big factor for them. And I guess question for you here that comes to mind, Jason, is if you were to go to bed tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Marketplacer is fully realized, what does that world look like?
It's really simple. You know, it's ultimately selling on autopilot. I think all of these businesses are just, they've taken too long and they've cost too much. And there's so many manual processes in the past in it. So you imagine a platform where you can just plug in the world of supply. It tells you what to sell, tells you how much to sell it for. It makes sure it gets fulfilled. It opens up a world of unlimited growth on a global basis without the need of holding any inventory or capital behind it. So, you know, ultimately that's what we're creating behind Marketplacer, is this concept of, you know, your ultimate growth autopilot on a global basis.
So then for this too, I want to ask you as well, thinking about scale, you know, how have you guys thought about scale, and how do you go about figuring out scale?
Yeah, and I think scale comes in many forms and many sizes, right? Like, so we had to scale. We started this business in Australia. We had to scale out of Australia. So we probably too early in our journey, just through the necessity of getting out of a pretty small country, is we had to internationalize the product. So, and in doing that, now, you know, the product has unbelievable product fit in the United States and North America and right through Europe. So our first point in the product journey is, how do you scale a product so it can work in the markets you want to exist in there? And then when we ultimately thought about scale in what we're doing, is where are ultimately our customers living, and how can we get to them in the fastest way? Well, they're already living on e-commerce engines, aren't they? So whether you're Tesco, or whether you're on Shopify, or whether you're on BigCommerce, if we want to empower growth for every e-commerce business on the planet, well, where are those e-commerce businesses living? So what we went out and did is we made amazing connections and relationships with the e-commerce platforms, and just made it so easy and fast for anyone using any e-commerce platform on the planet to turn into a marketplace instantly. So we launched what we call Fast Start now, is where we can turn, if you're on BigCommerce, we can get you up and running in a really cool way and start your marketplace journey or category extension journey in a completely frictionless way. So when we talk to scale, we talk to every e-commerce business on the planet and turning them into a marketplace. And then the second piece of that puzzle is, yes, we're a technology company, but ultimately, if we're going to solve that problem, we've got to come out of the box with all the suppliers. So you know, what we've really heavily focused on over the last couple of years is becoming the biggest marketplace of every product supply base in the world as well. So, you know, when we think of the three things, you know, you've got huge consumer base through our customers and our network, leveraging that network effect of those commerce businesses that exist there, and then out of the box, every supply that you could ever imagine. So we make it easier and faster than anyone else to create or to grow on the planet.
Especially for the people that are listening, you know, I want to ask you something here, because we've been talking about the future too. We've been talking about scale. I want to talk about the past and doing so with a lens of reflection. You know, let's say I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, you know, maybe to 2007 when you were thinking about starting something of your own. Let's say you had the opportunity of having a chat with your younger self. If you were able to be right there with that younger Jason and give that younger Jason one piece of advice before launching a business, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
I think it's a really good question. And so if you think of founders and what makes founders successful over somebody else, and including myself is in there, is the ability to be yourself and to be a founder. And it's completely okay to be that person within it, because the reason you're successful is because you can make fast decisions, is because you're not afraid of failing, is because you can think of things that others can't think of, is that because you can make a really complex problem so simple that the world can use it in a really cool way. And, you know, I think there's so many naysayers out there to say, don't do this for these reasons. And you know, you've got to achieve, you've got to do it in this way because this is the way everybody else does it. But if you're a founder and you truly believe in your vision, I would say don't let the naysayers stop you. Be the maverick that's inside you and do it at an incredible pace, where sometimes you will rattle the cage, and that's completely fine. Because if everybody's happy all of the time in everything that you do, the chances are you're not disrupting anything fast enough within it. So I would say go harder, go faster, and go sooner.
Love it. So Jason, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Just connect on LinkedIn is probably the best way. So Jason YWYAWT, and you know, it'd be great to connect. And yeah, thanks for the time today.
Amazing. Well, Jason, thank you so much. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
My pleasure.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.